towards the end there, we have the that paragraph. Let's see, it's 2, 3, 4 from the bottom. It says, offering and keeping precepts make the foundation necessary to build a great castle on. And then the endurance and effort are the walls of the castle. And then the meditation and wisdom are personal armor. Offering and keeping precepts. The word offering there, really, we're talking about generosity. So, of course, we're going to use the term offering because in this sutra itself, the Buddha is relaying this idea of giving away, which, of course, that is the root of that is generosity, as he mentions later, that it can't be a contrived thing. And the whole reason why this is so important and is the foundation, which, by the way, if you look at this little paragraph here, he's talking about a building. If you know anything of construction, if you try to build a house or any building, even a shed, and you have no foundation, yeah, it's not going to really work. As soon as you try to raise the walls, they're going to do this kind of thing. And you can try and brace it all you want, but I mean, it's not going to last very long. It's going to be very, very weak. So the concept here is has really nothing to do at all with your pocketbook. We in the West, being from this Abrahamic philosophy or influence, the Judeo-Christian kind of thing, offering is certainly about the pocketbook because that's how it's presented. You have to, at minimum, give 10% of your paycheck away, right? I mean, there's all kinds of, you have to be affording these things. And the Buddha says, that's not what we're doing here at all. In fact, we're trying to develop a general sense of generosity, not in order to keep an organization running or make a teacher wealthy or whatever may be behind the idea of giving financial wealth. And then when you look at that list of what he says, you know, if you have no money, here's these other things that you can do. Certainly if you have some money, you should be supporting the teachings. Otherwise, how are we ever going to get them? Right? If all the teachers have to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week at a mundane job, do you really think they're going to have any time at all to teach us? So, I mean, we have to make some kind of effort in order to make it so that the environment, and that's the other thing, where are they going to teach us? In a coffee shop? Sure, you could do that if there's one or two of you. But if you're trying to go and perform practices and the meditations, I mean, most coffee houses are not going to allow that. If we went in there with all of this stuff and we go, oh yeah, we're going to take over these five tables, set up a shrine, ring bells, blow some horns, play on some drums, you know, and all that, I did throw us out. This isn't in a church, you can't do this. So here in the West, yeah, we kind of need that because we're not allowed to just go set up a tent in a park and then live there and have services. They just don't allow it. It doesn't work here. So there is some of that aspect in it. But generosity is all about and specifically focuses on this idea of enlarging ourselves. Most of the time we are so, I mean far more than most of the time, we are so protective of ourself. We're very, very closed. So the idea of generosity is the concept of that is to expand ourself. That is, to make ourselves open to others. The best way to do that is to recognize need. They always say, you know, one of the greatest things is you invite people for dinner, right? You share meals. And by sharing meals, there's all kinds of wonderful things that take place. There's this whole sense of community that gets built and so on and so forth, which was one thing that I really did enjoy about the Jewish community, is that every weekend, which is the big holy day, everybody gets together. So there's a few people that they open their houses and everybody goes to those houses. So you have this wonderful, huge community meal. And it was really great. I mean, it's powerful. And a lot of people did just sleep there too. It's like, oh, you don't want to walk home. You know, you can stay here. And so there's this, you know, people all walk together back to, you know, the services tomorrow in the morning. And so it's a very powerful and great thing. So generosity shows us or gives us the opportunity to expand from our stinginess to the needs of others. And the Buddha says this is a critical fundamental point. Why are we needing to do that? Because it's the only way we can actually become compassionate. If you're not willing to be generous with your time, your energy, the information you know, skills you might have, or whatever else there might be, then how are you going to be compassionate to those that are in need of that? So if I'm a mechanic, and I certainly know how to fix cars, because I do it for a living, I mean, I don't really, but in this thing, I'm a professional driver, which I don't know, anybody near, right? But so this idea, if I'm a mechanic, and my neighbor or the guy down the street, I see that they have the hood open of their car and they're kind of doing this thing, and they don't even know what they're looking for. And I just, you know, happen to walk by and I say, oh, what's wrong with the car? Oh, it won't start. It just makes this clicking sound. And I go, oh, okay, well, good luck with that. And then I think to myself, oh, I've got such compassion because I wish that guy luck. Right? Or I say, well, you know, if you have AAA, you can get it towed for free, and somebody will look at that. How compassionate would we think that is? Right? Versus if I said, oh, yeah, that may be the starter, but let me go grab some tools and I'll be right back. Right? And then I check it out. Now, it doesn't mean that I necessarily have to rip his entire motor apart. I mean, I could locate the issue and say, oh yeah, well, here's the problem, and that, you know, this could take a while. You could bring it by the garage, or if you want, you know, we could try and work on this and offer some service there. Obviously, for the other person, it would also be their opportunity to practice generosity if they paid for the service. And that's where he says, without asking. So if I say, yeah, you know, let's, I think that's the starter, let's, you know, take that out and test that. And then the guy says, oh, you know, let me give you something for your help here. All of a sudden, we have this community thing happening. And there's an equal exchange of energy happening. And everybody's being quite compassionate. There's a weird thing that happens when you begin to become very generous, even in your words. Like if you say hello or how are you doing to everyone you meet, eventually this grows into something also. And I think that's in that list, that, you know, if you say something, say some things nice to somebody, that is also a form of offering or generosity, is your speech. But the more you do this, and the more the heart opens up, and there's this compassion that begins growing, it starts to ignite something. That thing that it ignites is loving kindness, which is the other side of that coin. The coin is actually, one side is compassion and the other side is loving kindness. And the Buddha says that is the fundamental thing that you need for this path. In fact, it's so important, he created an entire system called Bodhisattva. Bodhisattvayana, the path or the vehicle of the Bodhisattva. And he says, in fact, once he created this path, he says, I'll tell you what, you can't attain complete and total enlightenment, anuttara samyaksambodhi, without accomplishing the path of a bodhisattva, which is the epitome of compassion and loving kindness. So though we have this nice little list here, the reality is we can never attain enlightenment without the very first one, generosity. And generosity starts with some form of offering, some form of giving away. And as you may have heard, if you paid attention when we did the offering of the mandala, it's I'm offering all of these things without any sense of regret, without any sense of loss. If we have a sense of loss, we have a big problem because we're not actually being open at all. It's contrived, it's forced. There's a scene from an old film, kind of old, not really that old, but that I really love. I'm not going to tell you the movie, but I'll explain the scene, where this guy is really in love with this woman who happens to be much older than him, and he decides that he wants to give her a gold ring. You know, he wants to give something to show his great love for this woman. And so he's like, I'm going to do an offering of gold. And he hands her the gold ring. And they're, you know, on the cliff of the beach, you know, and it's very beautiful scene here. So he hands it to her, and she's like, oh, this is so lovely, you know, beautiful. And he's super excited, you know, oh, I'm glad you like it. And then she turns and throws it in the ocean. And he freaks out. What are you doing? What? Why'd you throw that ring in the ocean? You know, there's my gift. It's a symbol of my great love, and you just throw it in the ocean. What happened? And she goes, oh, this way I always know where it is. That's a really, from a Buddhist perspective, that's a beautiful scene. That's really quite amazing. This idea of, so for her, throwing this into the ocean, the movie was probably not saying this, but if we were to twist it a little bit for our own devices here, we could say that making an offering like that, throwing something out there, well, I always know where that is. So if I give something away, I'm not actually ever losing it. I know it's out there somewhere. I had a teacher once tell me that you can never actually lose anything. And so the question was, well, what do you mean by that? He says, it's always going to be somewhere on earth. So you always know where it is. You may not know the exact location, but you always know that it's here. So you haven't really lost it because it's always in your possession. It's in your room somewhere. Earth is our room. We can't lose stuff to the moon or to the Mars. That would be crazy. So, but we can certainly lose something here. Our problem is the stinginess wants us to have maximum control of that thing. that if it's not actually in my greedy little hands, I don't have it. But if you're a citizen of Earth, the whole place is your home. So there's nothing here that is lost to you because it's always here. Kind of like I went to, and visited Machu Picchu, five, 6 years ago, something like that. One of the greatest trips I'd ever been to. It's a magnificent place. Everybody should go. And it is as spectacular as it is. You know, I didn't want to leave when I was there. But then I had this realization, well, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to take it off the mountain and drag it to my home and put it in my backyard? I mean, it would take up the whole city block, but is that what I'm thinking I'm going to do with it? And on the way out, as I'm contemplating this stuff in my head, there's this big sign, you know, that it is this World Heritage Site. And I thought, of course, World Heritage, it belongs to everybody on the whole planet. Which means I always have Machu Picchu. It's like a cabin. If I want, I just make a trip down there and I go to my cabin, which just happens to be this giant city on top of a mountain in the Andes. When we start thinking this way, we start becoming more open. Yeah, that's kind of easier to do because did I own it in the first place? Well, I probably didn't. I have no sense of ownership. But when we begin to look at our objects like that and think, but everybody actually owns this. I'm just entrusted with it at the moment. And you should think that way because as soon as you're dead, you're not going to be entrusted to it anymore. Somebody's going to take over that object. Generosity is the number one way to create a sense of openness. The precepts, which are the second part of this statement here that makes our foundation, is very important. Another term for precepts is samayas, or commitments, and oaths or vows that we make. These are important because they are like the guidelines that keep us from going crazy. They're not rules per se. I know it looks like that in this sutra because, first of all, we have to understand that the collection of this sutra comes from the very first turning. The very first turning, Buddha was, in all reality, very legalistic because he's got a whole bunch of people that know nothing. And the Buddha is creating this new system. So he says, wherever you're from, whatever practices you have been doing, this is how we're going to do it here. And because there's widespread corruption in everything that people are doing, we're going to try to fix that. So he says, I'm going to create these rules in order so that we can get some bearings on what we would consider a reasonable morals to be. Now, as you grow in Dharma, this may be the first thing that you encounter because you really have no guidelines for what to do or how to behave. So we take these on. Later, we kind of take a different approach to them. And then in the highest form of trainings, they're not actually rules or regulations at all. So in the beginning, we need some guidelines. We need some things to help us formulate and shape our view from being an unwholesome view I don't like the word right view, even though you saw it listed in there, because right is not in contrary to wrong. We don't have a right and wrong in the Buddhism. That's not what the Buddha meant. When Buddha says right view or right livelihood, he means a naturally abiding view or livelihood that is in support of what we're trying to accomplish, which is becoming enlightened. So not to go too far off topic, but a hitman is not exactly a job that is going to create the mindset of being compassionate and having all this loving kindness and being very open and supportive. I know that might shock some people, but it's not exactly a very good career move if you're trying to attain enlightenment and be compassionate, because your job is, we're going to pay you $40,000, shoot that guy in the head. Okay. You don't even care what the story is. See, so it's not that the job is wrong, it's just that the job does not actually correlate or even support the idea of being a compassionate and helping person that's full of love and kindness. That's what he means by right. So our right view means that we have to begin to have this, we have to change our perception of how we view others, how we view our friends, how we view strangers, and how we view our enemies. Because the way that we've normally been looking at them does not actually support generosity. It doesn't support the methods to become generous. So Buddha says, all right, let's work on this. Let's put some guidelines so that we can kind of get our bearings on what things are wholesome for this path in order to accomplish your goal. Those of you that are here today, and I know you, you're here because you have decided you have a very specific goal, which is enlightenment. You're wanting to attain that for various reasons. Maybe at the moment it's small and you're just tired of suffering. That's okay. Maybe you do have this grand idea that you see others suffering so much that you want to be of help to them. And any methods that you have not really been all that great, because when you look backwards, you're making all these problems in your own wake in order to try and help others. So you're turning to this in order to perfect yourself so that you can benefit others in a true way. That's great. That's a bodhisattvic mentality. That's where we want to go with it. But the bottom line is the goal is enlightenment and how to get there. So Buddha says, I'm going to put down some guidelines to help you get your bearings that will point you in the direction to get there. And if you go outside of these, you won't have the support of this system to attain that goal. That's what it is. That's all it is. Because in the Buddhism, we don't really judge somebody as being a good person or a bad person. Anytime you see that, and if you do see it within the Buddhist community, then the person that's doing that obviously has no knowledge of Dharma. They're probably the donkey hanging out with the cows, to be quite honest. The idea of the precepts is not a control thing. The idea of precepts is, okay, you want enlightenment. The first thing we need to do is to become more generous, more compassionate. With every aspect, we need to be more open with our energy. We need to be more open with our language. We need to be more open with our possessions, skills, etc. Wisdom, whatever it is. And the proper way to do that is these things. Stop killing people, for one. That's really good. We want to quit doing that. So you see, the hitman, his job doesn't even, right off the bat, doesn't quite relate. A doctor, on the other hand, that's fine. There's no problem with that. But when we have professions that aren't really helping others, they're not beneficial. So the Buddha says, look, we have to stop stealing from others. We really need to do that. And we need to really stop slandering other people. Because that's not helpful either. You can't do that. We got to stop deceiving them. So if you're a salesperson or a businessman, you need to quit lying about what you're doing to what's going to happen to that person. Like, hey, yeah, we'll happily give you this loan because we see that you're in need. And then you don't tell them in the fine print that it's a 2,000% APR. And they have to pay it off in 6 months or you take their house, right? That's not good for people. So there are, the rest of the precepts, which we won't go through all of those. But this is what Buddha means by building this foundation. We need some basic guidelines to begin to work with. And it's not that you're supposed to just instantly, magically follow them. The idea is that when you take these precepts, you say, okay, well, if Buddha did this in order to attain this goal, I'm going to try it. And when you take it, you constantly look at how you normally behave versus what the precept tells you. So when the precept says stop killing, but you find that you're killing all the time, you have a habit. And there's something in that. It's very strange that when I took precepts, and this idea of no killing, it slowly started to work and churn its way into all these different areas. All of a sudden my friends were making fun of me because I would go through all kinds of crazy antics to try to save a housefly. To catch them without harming them and get them outside. Especially because I had cats, and the cats, they want to play with it, kill it, jump on it, whatever. And so I'm like keeping the cats away, trying to catch this fly, put it outside, or whatever it might be. But I wasn't thinking, oh, I have to do it because the precept tells me to. It was interesting that after the fact, when everybody was making fun of me, it was, oh, wow, yeah, where did that come from? Because before, man, I would have just let the cats at it, or would have smacked it with a fly swatter or whatever. I mean, it would have been a whole different situation. So we have to have these. It's very, very important. Where's the list here? My page just jumped out at me here. Offerings and keeping precepts to make the foundation. So in the same way that effort and endurance, I'm not going to go too much longer here, but I do want to make sure that there's no mistake or misunderstanding of this line. It says that it protects you from enemies from the outside. Very quickly, the walls of the castle, what this means is that when we begin to become generous, through making offerings of various kinds, and we begin to follow the precepts, the diligence and the effort that we put in to maintain those two things, or to practice them, to be more open and putting effort in that, being more diligent about paying attention to the vows that we have. What we are really doing is we are protecting the information that comes in through the eyes, through the nose, through our sense of taste, through our ears, through the sense of touch. And we're protecting ourselves from the misinformation about the outer world. There's no monsters or demons or a Satan or any of that kind of stuff that's coming after you and attacking you. That's not what it means. And it certainly doesn't mean that diligence and effort is going to protect us from that crazy liberal down the street that's going to come and beat us up. That's not what we mean by protecting us from the outside. It means that we're protecting ourselves from the misinformation of experience. It's very important to understand that. So I wanted to touch on that because a lot of people think that so when we get on this path, we're going to do this generosity and stuff, but we're also going to guard ourselves against all those heathens. That there's no such thing as heathens. There's only people like us that are deluded. Buddhism says there's only two things: the fully enlightened and those not enlightened. There's nothing in between. So if we're also one of the unenlightened, it means that we don't, a like kind, they're not enemies. So the other deluded people are not our enemies, they're just in the same boat we are. Whether they're attempting to attain enlightenment, it has nothing to do with making them an enemy or not. There aren't any. So the enemies from outside are mistaken views of reality. That's the enemy from outside. Okay. Back up. So let's go into our Transforming the Mind worksheet here.